Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Growth Matters Radio.
Good morning. Here we are for another session of Growth Matters, and it's a Sunday day here in Atlanta. And my name is Michelle Matthews, and I'm looking forward to just talking with you about an issue that is very important to me about women and girls and how we're setting ourselves up for success. And, you know, as when we started Growth Matters, a lot of times when I talk to people about it, you're thinking about an organization, particularly in the for-profit world, you know, how you're growing, how you're growing profits. But as we conceptualize this show, it's really important to me that we not only talk about for-profit businesses, but we also talk about other organizations that grow, particularly nonprofits, and that we also look at sort of the environment that we're in and what are some of the factors that influence whether we are growing as a healthy business, organization, community, and as a global economy. And so kind of with that as a foundation, I'm really excited about the two executives that we have here today and the organizations that they are a part of. So our first guest is Kelly Dolan. She is the executive director of Atlanta Women's Foundation. And those of you in Atlanta that are in the nonprofit sector and in for-profit are probably aware of this foundation. But their mission is really to be a catalyst for change in the lives of women and girls and to end generational poverty. And also on our show, we have Carrie Davis, who is the executive director of the Southeast Region for CARE USA. And CARE is a leading humanitarian organization that really focuses on fighting global poverty. And although they look at sort of individuals and families as a whole, they also have a special focus on women and thinking about how to equip them with the resources and help them be more empowered for their families in the entire community. So I'm excited to get into the conversation. Welcome, Carrie, and welcome, Kelly.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank
you.
Glad
to be here.
So sort of in light of how I've given the intro and thinking about sort of these issues, Kelly, talk to us a little bit about the mission of Atlanta Women's Foundation and some of the things that you do in the Atlanta community.
Sure. Well, the Atlanta Women's Foundation has actually been in existence since the mid-'80s. It was 1986, and we've been an organization that's been primarily a funding organization to grassroots community efforts that raise up women and girls. And so we've had a tremendous track record of support in the community for that. What we did as an organization is about 2 years ago, we decided to take a look from a research standpoint to really see what was holding women and girls back in Atlanta. So while we'd been a funding organization, we had run the gamut. We had funded everything from early childhood education programs to mentoring programs to breast cancer programs. I mean, anything that was raising up and helping women and girls. And the original mission was to be a catalyst for change in the lives of women and girls, which is obviously quite broad. So what we did was we realized that we were starting to fund primarily in the anti-poverty space, that what kept bubbling up in the grant-making process was the primary needs of women and girls in Atlanta. And we said, okay, we're funding these programs sort of, I don't want to say on a one-off basis, but a bit on a one-off basis, that best program proposal won. But what we realized was there was really a systemic problem. You know, what was actually happening in Atlanta? How can we get our arms around systemically what was holding back women and girls? And so we engaged Beth Shapiro, Shapiro Associates, to do some research on that. And what we really identified was that generational poverty and the cycle of generational poverty was what was really holding back women and girls. So what does that mean? And how can we identify what the barriers are that are keeping these women and girls in generational poverty and how we as an organization can adopt that as our mission so that we're not only just funding in that space, but we're raising the level of awareness for the broader community about the issue and how it's affecting not just women and girls, but the community as a whole, and how we can advocate for change on the policy level. So we have interestingly narrowed our focus yet broadened our platform.
Yeah.
And so that's, and we're very excited about it. So we're going to continue to certainly fund in that space and fund those grassroots organizations that are providing the services that are needed, but we also want to raise the level of awareness about this.
So before I go to Carrie and give her an opportunity to talk about CARE and the work they do, you know, for our listeners, Kelly, who might be in the for-profit space and they're thinking about growing their business, tell me a little bit about, you know, how do we make that connection so that people can see that the things that are happening in our community, particularly with women and girls, have an influence on the prosperity of Atlanta and other organizations?
Oh, well, it's tremendous. I mean, first of all, we want to have, for business to grow in Atlanta, we need to have an educated workforce. And if we have, you know, 81,000 girls woke up this morning just in the five counties we serve in Atlanta in poverty, and nearly 320,000 women and girls are in poverty. And what that means is that this is a group of people in a population that isn't being educated properly, and they are not prepared to be the workforce that we need in Atlanta to make sure that the community continues to grow. They also, just from a straight-up humanitarian standpoint, I mean, what are we doing in terms of the social services that are needed to that need to be provided for these women and girls? And frankly, what drain does that have on our economy? So looking at it from both the proactive standpoint that we need to have you know, economically self-sustaining women and girls that can provide a basis for a good workforce for to help our businesses grow and the community grow, but also how do we eliminate that drain on the economy and the tax base and also on what's happening in healthcare, which we could sit here for another whole hour on healthcare, frankly, especially this week. But so it's really, it's to me, I see it two ways. So, you know, we need to take care of people in our community. That to me is the bottom line. That's what I get up and do every day. But also from a growth standpoint for the community, we need to have, you know, we need to have a healthy, well-educated workforce for the community to continue to grow and thrive.
Great. So, Carrie, talk to us a little bit about CARE as an organization, and if you could also make the link of, you know, why CARE in Atlanta is a good fit and good for our community.
That's great. Sure, I'd be thrilled. Well, CARE has been around for almost 70 years, and we began with the CARE package, which is now part of the American lexicon. Many people don't realize that the CARE package is linked to CARE, the organization based right here in Atlanta. But in the aftermath of World War II, when Europe was completely ravaged, people were starving. And CARE packages were sent to families and individuals, and they contained basic food items. So there was margarine and flour and Spam, for example, in these packages that literally helped families survive the aftermath of the war. And there are still CARE package recipients and senders living today who are in their 80s and 90s, and their stories are really phenomenal. The CARE packages represented more than just the practical food stuff. They actually represented hope and goodwill at a time that was very bleak. And CARE has evolved significantly in the last 70 years. We have moved from direct aid to a much more integrated approach to working on building local capacity in communities and, as you mentioned, focusing on the empowerment of girls and women. So it's really interesting to hear Kelly talk about the work of the Atlanta Women's Foundation here because, in fact, CARE's mission bears so many similarities. We work across a whole range of programmatic sectors. So we work in water and sanitation, maternal and child health, nutrition, economic development, agriculture. But through all of that work, we approach it through a gender lens. So we're always thinking about girls and women as the catalyst for change in their communities because we know that the ripple effect when we invest in girls and women is truly remarkable. So that's an overview of CARE, and I'd love to comment on the connection to Atlanta. There was a shared vision among city leaders 20 years ago in bringing CARE to Atlanta, and that vision really drew on Atlanta's reputation, growing reputation, as a premier international city. And that was founded on Atlanta's position as a global health capital, as having a tremendous legacy in civil and human rights, having a growing global commerce that was really something that was a point of pride in thinking about Atlanta versus other American cities, and also Atlanta as a growing philanthropic community with a lot of nonprofits centered here. So we see just a wonderful connection to Atlanta in thinking about all of those shared values and then the opportunity for CARE to contribute to Atlanta's reputation on the world stage.
Great. Well, thanks for giving us a little bit more about CARE and the Atlanta Women's Foundation, so it sets the context for today. When we talk with leaders of organizations, we also want to know a little bit about you. So, Carrie, I know that you're the executive director of the Southeast region. Mm-hmm. So, one, help our listeners understand sort of what that region is, and tell us how you came to CARE and sort of the nickel tour of your career that got you here.
Sure. So, I lead the Southeast region for fundraising. And the region is quite sprawling. It's actually Maryland, south to Florida, and even includes Texas, which I don't think Texans would really appreciate being called the Southeast region. However, I used to live in Austin, so that's why I kind of took on Texas. But it has been an amazing journey for me to CARE. I've actually been at CARE for 5 years now. I started as a history teacher and worked in the private boarding school world for my 5 years out of college, and loved it, and it was a very rewarding environment. Boarding school environment is very insular, though, in some ways. And so I was looking to spread my wings and ended up working as a fundraiser at Salem Academy and College as my next phase of my career. And Salem is the oldest school in the country dedicated to women's education, founded in 1772. And I had a really remarkable journey there. I found that it was tremendously exciting to take my love of education and translate it into leveraging resources to support that mission. And so fast forwarding to CARE, I had been at Salem for about 8 years. And again, it was just really fulfilling for me. And I had met this whole constellation of alums who are still very dear to my heart, were tremendous role models for me. But I was ready to spread my wings because we had been through a comprehensive campaign and we had met our goal a year ahead of schedule, and it seemed like a good time for a new challenge. And I learned that CARE was looking to hire a fundraiser in Atlanta. And at the time, I was living in North Carolina, and I was generally familiar with CARE through the CARE package, being a history major. But I got on CARE's website, and I have to tell you, my heart really leapt. I had this very strong, immediate response to the mission, and I found myself poring over the web pages and watching the videos and feeling just a real elevation, you know, and a desire to be a part of this. And so happily, that all worked out, and I moved to Atlanta 5 years ago. And I actually was born in Atlanta, so it was really great to come back 30 years later and reconnect with the city, and I'm just so happy to be here.
Great. Kelly, tell us a little bit about your background and what's led you to lead this organization.
Sure. Well, I'm actually a Chicago native, so I was born and raised in Chicago, and I actually started my career in advertising and marketing. So I started with Leo Burnett in Chicago. So for anyone who understands advertising, it was the largest advertising agency in the world at the time. So I came out of that space. I was moved to Atlanta for personal reasons, and so I had to sort of reinvent. And I worked with some agencies in Atlanta for a few years, but actually I was recruited to go to Eggleston Children's Healthcare System, which is now Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, in the early 90s. And so I joke and say that I entered the dark side of nonprofits in the early 90s and never looked back. So it was truly life-changing for me. I was hired into that role as a marketing person for the hospital. But as we all know, with nonprofits, marketing and fundraising always go hand in hand. And I was absolutely captured by the fact that I could get up and go to work every day and help children survive critical illnesses and injuries. And it was not a platitude to say my worst day there was better than any day I had in an agency. So because of the work that we were able to do every day for these children. So So I never, you know, from there, I traveled through, stayed mostly, I've spent most of my career since then in healthcare nonprofits. Most recently, I was with, after Eggleston, I did a few other things with smaller nonprofits, but I was with Susan Komen for The Cure. I was the executive director here in Atlanta for 8 years and had the privilege of building that organization in Atlanta and funding each year local breast cancer organizations every year to the $2 to $2.5 million range in the city, and then, of course, funding the national research program. So I just was... It's very important to me that money that stays in the Atlanta community helps the underserved population, which is what we did for 8 years at Komen. So we made sure that every woman in the 10-county area had access to screening. So what I was excited about with this opportunity at the Atlanta Women's Foundation is that I got to continue to do local grant making, and I got to continue to stay in a women-serving and girl-serving organization, but I get to do it on a broader platform. So no longer do I just get to fund in the breast cancer space, but I get to really look at this entire population and see what kind of wraparound services are needed. And after 8 years of doing community needs assessment, I have a pretty good idea of what's missing for these women and girls in the community, and now I'm part of an organization that has that broader platform. So it was absolutely no question about it, right place, right time for me to make the change. And I just started in July, and we are off and running.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I was reading, as I was doing a little research for this program and having both of you on, is that in Newsweek they talked about investing in women and how it pays dividends. And I read something I thought was really interesting. Women are more likely than men to put their income back into the local community to help drive a number of different initiatives. So that really brings some shared value to both the companies, the women, and our community. Mm-hmm. Can you maybe highlight a current initiative or something that the Atlanta Women's Foundation is either working on or funded and help us understand how that has maybe changed some lives for those in our community?
Well, I'll tell you what we're doing right now, which is really exciting, is that we have combined four organizations that are women-driven organizations. So I think this, to me, is the best example of this. So we are partnering with the Atlanta Jewish Women's Fund, which is part of Jewish Federation, the Junior League of Atlanta, and the Women's Leadership Alliance with United Way, and the Atlanta Women's Foundation. And we've put together a collaboration. And what we're going to be doing is working with a local civic site, the Casey Dunbar Civic Site, and we are going to actually, as a joint effort, going to be doing mobility mentoring for women that are part of that civic site. So they already are accessing all of the service that the Dunbar Civic Site gives them, but now we're going to be adding another layer of this mentoring. So we have funding that all of those organizations have put towards this, and we're working collaboratively with that organization. And I think it's a great example of women understanding the power of not only funding in the local community, but actually giving hours and time and giving expertise. So what we're going to be doing is blending the best of what the Casey Dunbar Civic Site is already doing, but then we're going to be accessing the expertise of all the women that serve in these organizations to actually become mentors to that. So, you know, when you read all of the data on how women give and how women give differently in philanthropy and all that, one of the things that you learn quickly is that women need to be told the whole story. They don't like high-pressure sales tactics. They don't like direct mail. They want to touch and feel and be a part of whatever the experience is in the area that they're interested in supporting. And so we want to make sure that we give opportunity for that so that women, they want to be invested both in their time and their spirit in addition to their funding. And so this program is a great example of that.
Yeah. So, Carrie, talk to us a little bit about a current initiative or something that Kara's working on that can help our listeners better understand how you really make an impact.
Sure. I think I'd like to highlight a model that Kara pioneered back in 1991 in Niger, and it's called the Village Savings and Loan Method. And some of you may be familiar with this, but it's a really simple model. It involves bringing together groups of 20 to 30 people, typically mostly women, because women tend to be more motivated initially to join these groups. They save a small amount of money every week, typically, and it may be as few as 5 cents. And over time, as they generate more savings, they begin to make loans to one another. And these loans are quite small in the beginning, and they may be used to buy something like sweet potato seeds to expand the crop. And then with the profit that's made from the sale of the sweet potato, they may make another investment, for example, in chickens and sell the eggs at market. And then with the profit from that, they may start a small business, a little store in the village selling basic foodstuffs and supplies. And the group develops this tremendous solidarity and trust because they're meeting every week and they're sharing their experiences, their struggles, their victories. And it's quite a phenomenal experience because the emotional and social bonds that form are really deep. And many of these members have never had the experience of meeting in a group like this and sharing those daily struggles and joys. And what CARE has found is that while this breeds a tremendous economic opportunity, it also gives us an avenue for training on issues related to health or education. And so what we found is that this model works so well. It requires very little infusion of capital. CARE actually does not put money into the loan structure. The women save the money themselves, and so there's a tremendous amount of pride of ownership. And I saw these groups in Rwanda and in Ethiopia, and we heard members talk about how, particularly for the women, they developed such confidence and a sense of their own voice, the ability to negotiate with their husbands about most basic household decisions, for example, investing in their children's education. And it was really remarkable to me to think about the ripple effect that was made possible through that very simple exercise. And that model has now been replicated. There are 120,000 of these groups now across sub-Saharan Africa. And we have very bold plans for extending it further.
Wow. So exciting and very powerful to see how you can take something small and that you can grow it so that it not only, like you said, changes their life, but changes the lives of those in their community. Kelly, one of the things when you were sharing about a little bit of the shifts that you're making within the organization, I know that when you're trying to be more focused in a particular area, you have to think differently about how you perhaps lead, how you perhaps build your infrastructure. Talk a little bit sort of about the internal implication of the fact that you are narrowing your focus and you're making some shifts. That'd be very helpful for the others that are leading transformation in their organization.
Sure. I think what you have to do is, you know, in the nonprofit sector, we always talk about that you lead with mission. So everything starts with that. And so we took a look at the four or five areas that we're really going to focus on, and then how do you staff around that? So that's really what we're looking at. But what we have in particular as a nonprofit is the challenge of fundraising. So so you lead with mission in terms of where you want to be strategically as an organization. But right next to that all the time in a nonprofit is how do you fund it? So there's always that push-pull of this is ideally how we want to put resources behind the cause, and this is the realistic version of it, of what it is based on funding. And so that's the point that we're at right now with the Atlanta Women's Foundation. So many people think we have a large staff. We don't. We only have a staff of six at the foundation. And it, to me, it's a testament to how strong our board is and how strong our volunteer leadership is that we're able to have this much impact on the community with that small a staff. So I think it's interesting. What we are doing is we are shifting focus on the fundraising side. And we are, what we've done is we have in our community initiatives area, which is the area that supports all the programming and all the grant making, we have ramped up the volunteer support around that to support the staff. And we've invested a little bit more on the fundraising side. We know we need to ramp up the fundraising, and from that comes more staff on the program side. So the great news is as since we are such an established organization and we have funders that are so involved, as I mentioned earlier, women want to be involved in the grant-making process. They want to touch and feel the grantees. We do site visits with all of our grantees. Our grant-making program is very airtight is the only word I keep coming up with. But, I mean, it's just very clean, it's very transparent, and it's very organized. So we're able to really capitalize on our board of directors and our community grant readers to really push that part of our agenda along beautifully. And at the same time, we can then, on the staffing side, ramp up on the, which we're doing now, on the fundraising area so that we continue to go really basically on both tracks. So that's a model that I've used with other organizations. It seems to work well. Because, again, it works very well to invite in your volunteer base, especially your knowledgeable volunteer base and your really committed volunteer base, to help you on the programming side. It works because it gives you the manpower you need to affect the change in the community. It also firmly cements their commitment to the cause, because the more people see the results of what's happening in the community and the really permanent impact that we're having on the lives of these women and girls. I mean, we're literally changing the trajectory of their lives. Our goal is to make them economically self-sufficient. This is not a Band-Aid. You know, this is a permanent fix, and we know what needs to be done to get to that level. It just recommits those folks. So it's really works beautifully as a cycle. They continue to fund at a higher level, and it helps the organization propel forward.
Kara, I was watching you. You were sort of shaking your head as Kelly was sharing a little bit about fundraising, which is, you know, lifeblood in a nonprofit mm-hmm. environment, and clearly something that you are focused on leading in the Southeast area. Talk to us a little bit mm-hmm. about how you're making that link, particularly since Kara and some of your successes are things that are happening globally and not necessarily right here in the Atlanta community. I would imagine that adds a little bit different element to the fundraising story that you tell.
Yeah, and actually this was one of the sea changes for me when I came from Salem to CARE. I came from a place where you have a built-in alumni network and a campus, so to speak, where all of the programs are kind of visible on a regular basis, to an organization whose work spans 84 countries and with a tremendous reach of, last year, 83 million people touched across this whole range of sectors. And how do you bring that work to life for people here in Atlanta? So if I could, I'd love to mention this event that we're having on October 11th, because it relates to the question. We undertook a really interesting process this summer. We sent staff to the field to visit 5 countries where CARE has a presence. And we went to Honduras, Ghana, Madagascar, India, and the Republic of Georgia. And we worked with girls who are involved in our education programs to help them make art to reflect their lives, their struggles, their accomplishments, their dreams. And the result is just remarkable. So we're actually putting this art on show next Friday at Maison Muir Fine Art Gallery. And it's going to be an incredible window into the world that these girls inhabit. It will reveal the impact that CARE is having in their lives. But I think even more importantly, it will really draw on the universal themes that unite us across countries and boundaries and cultures. And so I really invite any listener to join us that night, because this is the kind of thing that CARE is really wanting to do more of in Atlanta, to, again, give life to the work that we do in very remote places, bring it home to Atlanta, and actually bring the world to Atlanta through that process.
Yeah. So I think, Kelly, your organization also has an event that's coming up. But before I let you share a little bit about that, if someone is interested in participating in your event, Carrie, why don't you give them
sure.
a chance to let us know how they do that.
So if you'll go on our website, which is www.care.org, and then do /art, it's that simple. And you'll see all of the information about the exhibit, and you can purchase tickets for $50. We're going to have international music and food, and there will be open bar, and it's going to be just a really festive evening. We've also captured a lot of beautiful video and photography of the girls in these communities making the art. So it's going to be a multimedia experience. And we'll also have many of the colleagues who went on these trips present that night. So they'll be available to answer questions and talk about what the experience was like of actually being immersed in communities with the girls.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So, Kelly, you have an event that's coming up, so October is big for both of you. What's happening at the Atlanta Women's Foundation?
Why, thank you for asking, Michelle. We have our biggest event of the year. It's our largest fundraiser, and it's called Numbers Too Big to Ignore. And it's our luncheon. It's going to be at the Georgia Wool Congress Center, and we're going to have about 1,400 of our closest friends in attendance at that. We're going to have Susan Taylor, who was the editor of Essence magazine for about 30 years, who has now started a national mentoring program for young women, and she's going to be the keynote speaker. And the whole focus of the lunch is going to be to, again, lead the charge and educate the community, and it's going to be really primarily focused on those 81,000 girls who wake up in poverty every day in Atlanta, and we're going to be communicating that message in some very special ways, which I don't want to give away. I'm going to have some surprises as people walk in the door, but it's on October 23rd, so it's 2 weeks from Wednesday. People can go to AtlantaWomen.org and to sign up or to get tickets to that. And we still have some seats available, although it is filling up fast. We usually sell this event out, believe it or not, with that large amount of people. But the Georgia World Congress Center ballroom is expansive, so we're happy for that. So it's AtlantaWomen.org, and we're just delighted about it. The mayor is going to be speaking. We are going to be talking about how we're launching in earnest this program of making sure that we break this cycle of generational poverty for women and girls, and it really is a who's who of Atlanta, particularly it's men and women, but particularly all of the key businesswomen in Atlanta usually attend that lunch, so we're excited about it.
Yeah, that's great. And I just wanted to add, we actually have two events in a series to mm-hmm. celebrate CARE's 20 years in Atlanta. This year marks that that milestone for us, and we're very excited about it. So the October 11th event is the first, and it's actually on International Day of the Girl, which is the second annual day that the United Nations designated. So we felt that the art through the eyes of a girl was a wonderful way to pay tribute to the struggles and the aspirations of girls around the world. But on October 18th, we're actually having a dinner celebration at the Atlanta History Center to pay tribute to our 20 years in Atlanta. And the mayor will be speaking, and we have just a tremendous program, and again, international music and a celebrity chef design meal, and it's just going to be a terrific celebration. And also, I think, a reflection on that shared vision I was mentioning earlier about CARE's contribution to the city and our continued commitment to the city.
Yeah, great. So that's two different events, or three different events, that our listeners can put on their October calendars. Kelly, I want to go back to sort of the work that you do and your impact. And if I were to ask you, what is the biggest misconception, perhaps, that people have about women and girls and the connection to the community? What would you say are some of the things that you have to sort of fight to help people understand a little bit better in order to make a difference in the lives of these women and girls?
Well, I think the first thing is for people to understand that it exists. I think we're seeing it on the national level. I think people don't understand how many people are living in poverty among us, and in the United States and in Atlanta and in the five counties we serve. So I think raising awareness that of just educating people about the numbers of women and girls that are being affected and that are living day in and day out in poverty. I mean, I think that's a big issue. I think it's, they walk among us, and people don't realize that it could be somebody just down the street from them and that they're hanging on by a thread, quite frankly. So I think that's raising that level of awareness is going to be important. The other piece of it is that we really need to educate funders, and we need to educate the general public about the importance of wraparound services. That when you have a population that is living in a environment where when one thing goes wrong in their life, the domino effect that has on them, that people in the middle class and above can't relate to. They have no idea what that means. So, for example, people get frustrated because they start buying into stereotypes, and they say, well, there was, my organization had a training, a job skills training program, and there were some women that were in that job skills training program, and then suddenly some of them just never showed up. And so they said, they make assumptions. Well, they obviously didn't want to be job trained. Okay, well, here's the real answer. The real answer is that one of those women woke up and her 2-year-old had an ear infection and she didn't have health care and she didn't have a daycare center she couldn't send the kid to the daycare center if she had a daycare center, quite frankly, and there's a good chance she didn't, that she's using a network of family and friends to take care of her children and cobbles that together day in and day out on a week in, week out basis because she doesn't have any consistency in her life. She may not have a consistent home. She certainly doesn't have consistent public transportation in Atlanta. She certainly, all of these issues so that everything is if one thing goes wrong, her house of cards folds and it folds fast. And so that woman then, She misses her bus. She misses her connection to the second bus. She can't get there in time. She misses the program, and then she's told, "Well, you're not really a dedicated participant in this program," and she gets dropped from the program. This is reality. This is happening probably right this minute, and it's probably happening to a lot of women right now in Atlanta, and that's not an exaggeration. So I think we need to understand that funding one tiny program that we think is going to suddenly magically change this woman's life is just not realistic, and we need to understand the totality of what it is for them to live in poverty day in and day out, and the challenges that they have just to exist in the world, frankly, on a day-in, day-out basis and keep their head above water and take care of their children. So that's a complicated message, right, to communicate. But we got to start it. We got to start finding ways to clearly articulate that message in a way that people understand. And it's very difficult to understand and have empathy for something that has never affected your life.
And Kelly, just to make sure that our listeners, when you say wraparound services, mm-hmm. what exactly do you mm-hmm. Mean by that concept?
So we need to take a look at everything that's a barrier in somebody's life. So if health care is a barrier, that they have access to adequate health care so that they get the screening that they need so they don't show up at Grady presenting at stage 4 level breast cancer. So that, let's start there. We need to also look at what transportation is holding them back. We need to look at child care services. We need to look at job retraining. We need to look at what their housing situation is. We fund programs, that are important in that, for example, one of the programs that we're funding is at the Atlanta Children's Shelter. And that program, we're not funding operational costs of the Atlanta Children's Shelter, although let's be honest, that's very important. But what we're doing is we're funding a job retraining program because at the Atlanta Women's Children's Shelter, the women and children are there, and they are committed for long periods of time there so that they don't just go in for a night and come back out. It's a program that gives them full services and gives them a chance to get on their feet. And what we're funding is a job retraining program there. So those are the kinds of things that we need to look at. Where do we give these women the best opportunity to succeed? So funding one program and not recognizing that we need to fund other areas of their we need to provide services, not necessarily fund, but we may need to make sure they have access to services in all these other areas of their lives so that we give them at least a level playing field or at least a shot at a level playing field so that when we go in and we offer a job retraining program, they can actually show up to it on a consistent basis. And we also give them a sense of dignity that, that they don't feel like failures, that they don't feel that they're being, that they're being dismissed mm-hmm. because of circumstances that truly at some point are beyond their control. So how do we get them to a point where we give them a little bit of control over their life so they can, that they can get a running start?
Yeah.
I mean, it's vital. I mean, and it's just human. I mean, why aren't we doing this? The reason why, again, is because I think it's a tough message to deliver, but it's time for us to start delivering it.
Yeah. So, Carrie, I don't know if that's similar in terms of sort of the biggest misconceptions you have as you try to help people understand the work that you're doing and the reasons to support your organization, mm-hmm. or are there other things that you feel rise to the top.
Again, I am really struck by the similarities. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's really very powerful to reflect on that, because in CARE's experience, women bear the brunt, the disproportionate burden of poverty around the globe, and they are the most marginalized and typically underserved. And so CARE has focused on women and girls for two reasons. One, because they bear the brunt of poverty, and two, because they are the catalyst for change in communities. And when you invest in women, typically 70 to 80% of that investment feeds the family, and I mean that in a metaphorical sense. Whereas when you invest in men, and no offense, men, but about 30% is what we show ends up being invested in the family. So it's, in my experience, some of the greatest misconceptions are in realizing that around the globe, the barriers for girls and women are tremendous. And let me just give you an example. I had an opportunity to visit a wonderful program in Ethiopia last year that was focused on ever-married girls. So adolescent girls ages 14 to 19 who had already been married, and some were already divorced, and some were already widowed at this young age, and all had children. And CARE was working with these girls to empower them economically through that village savings and loan model that I told you about earlier, and also to enhance their social empowerment. So to help them have a voice, again, at the household level in making decisions, to enable them to speak out about the ravages of child marriage, because in essence, child marriage completely paralyzes girls in their ability to pursue educational opportunity. It puts them at tremendous health risk, and it also burdens them economically for the rest of their lives in diminishing their productivity. So child marriage comes to mind as an example of something that many Americans have really little knowledge of, and yet in the places where CARE works, it's a tremendous issue and really is one of those systemic issues that kind of shapes the rest of the work that we do.
Mm-hmm. So switching gears just a little bit for both of you, talk to me a little bit about the challenges you have related to leading these organizations. So talk to me a little bit about some of the things that you're having to grow in as leaders to help you better help your organizations grow and develop. I'm sort of looking to Kelly. You said that you're relatively new in uh-huh. the position, uh-huh. and so how is that playing out in terms of shifting maybe your leadership style uh-huh. or the way that you look at leadership?
Uh-huh. Well, I think most people who have had any leadership experience with a nonprofit recognize the fact that collaboration is the key. So unlike a CEO of a for-profit institution, you definitely have a board of directors that you report to, and if you're a public board, you certainly have shareholders that you report to, no question. But especially in private-owned for-profit businesses, you're the leader, and you're sort of the key decision maker, and it's a singular almost pursuit, right? When you're an executive director of a nonprofit, you report to your community board of directors, and it is a shared responsibility. So you and your board chair, and our board chair is Danita Knight, who is magical in all in every sense of the word. She's a tremendous volunteer leader for our organization. So what I'm looking at with the Women's Foundation, we have such a strong board, and we are so well represented in the community with our board, and we have. I want to make sure that I work collaboratively with these people and I maximize their time and their talent. And so that, to me, that isn't new to me with the Women's Foundation, but it is certainly ramped up. The board is so outstanding that I want to make sure that I find every opportunity I can to use them at their maximum service. And so that's my challenge now, is to figure out the best way that we can access the best of them in how we can propel the organization forward. So that's the first thing you do when you come into a nonprofit is you look at your board and you look at what your pipeline on your board is. I mean, a nonprofit's only as good as the board. I mean, people like to give a lot of credit to the staff. They like to, you know, I had a lot of rose petals thrown at me when I was executive director of Coleman for a lot of years, and Lila Hertz was the board chair that hired me. And Lila Hertz built that organization, not Kelly Dolan. And the same thing is happening at the Women's Foundation. Danita Knight is building that organization, not Kelly Dolan. But because you're the executive director and you're the consistent name and the board chairs change, you get a lot of credit for a lot of work that the community leaders are doing. So I think it's vital that I get to know that board. It's vital that I get to know what they're passionate about, what really drives them. You know, one thing I think is kind of funny, I think when you come in as a staff person, you know, you come in and when a new board member joins your board, you know a lot about them, right? You vetted them. It's, you know, it's a bit of a dating game. It's a courting process, you know, on both sides. And so very often in my career, I've made assumptions that a board member has come on and I've thought, oh, absolutely, this person wants to be in our development and fundraising committee. And it's always amusing to me when I sit down and I say, well, what do you want to do? Who do you want to be when you grow up, basically, you know, with our board? And they look at me, and I've had people say, you know, well, I want to be on the grant committee because I have this knowledge in this space. I would have had no idea that person had that or that what I think is lovely is when you can provide a seasoned executive, you know, somebody, because people that get to that elevate to a board at this level, these are, you know, we have the CEO of Grady, we have John Hoppert, you know, so how much can we really offer him in terms of new skills and knowledge base as an example? But I always think it's interesting when somebody comes to you and says, well, I've never done this X in my career, so I'd like to be on this committee because I want to take a look at that and I want to better understand how that works. And I think that's one of the that's a terrific thing about board service, is that you can dabble, if you will, in areas that maybe aren't really your day job, right? And so that's exciting. But then also the folks that have that expertise and that are willing to take it and serve on that committee that lines up with their expertise is just it's just amazing to me, and I think it's one of the many gifts of being in a staff role with a nonprofit, is to watch people, you know, it sounds corny, but, you know, I'm looking at Carrie, it's not, but to give, mm-hmm. and how they continue to give, and these incredibly busy people whose schedules are absolutely booked and insane, and how they can find time to carve out and continue to give to an organization. So my challenge as the staff leader of that is to maximize that as much as possible.
Carrie, what is a leadership challenge that you're having to grow into as you serve in your role at CARE?
You know, it's really similar in some ways, because as we talk about increasing CARE's presence and visibility in Atlanta, that's actually probably the most current area where I see we have an opportunity to exert greater leadership. And it's a tremendous opportunity. And as we've built this momentum through these events, we want to be able to capitalize on that in the best way. And I'm just thinking about an event that we had actually in September that was hosted by our newest board member, who is actually based here in Atlanta, named Martha Brooks, and her husband Toby. And it was an event to really raise awareness about CARE's work in economic development, market engagement, and social enterprise as a very innovative way to transform the lives of the extreme poor. And they did a phenomenal job of bringing in about 45 of their friends and members of their network to learn more about CARE's work in this arena. And as Kelly was saying, it always takes my breath away to see people whose love for the mission is so great and whose passionate commitment really propels them to take this kind of action on our behalf. And in the case of Toby and Martha Brooks, their son had done an internship with CARE in Bangladesh a summer ago and had this incredible hands-on experience of working with a micro-franchise network to benefit communities. And that really, I think, helped draw them particularly close to the work. And it was a wonderful chance for them to share, again, their commitment with the community. And I think we need to find more ways to do that, because nobody can tell the story better than our supporters. So
great. Well, this has been, I think, a very enlightening conversation today about what's happening in Atlanta related to women and children in poverty and how we help break that generational cycle, as well as some things that are happening globally. I would be remiss if I didn't give you both the opportunity to, again, give folks information about the events that are coming up for you as you celebrate your 20th year and as you do your annual fundraisers. So, Kelly, tell us again if our audience is interested in participating, where do they go and how do they get more information?
Sure. The event is Wednesday, October 23rd. It's a luncheon. It's called Numbers Too Big to Ignore, and you can go to atlantawomen.org, and we still have some tickets available, and we would welcome everybody.
Great. Carrie?
And I just have to say, I've been to the Numbers Too Big to Ignore luncheon, and it is awesome. So
thank you, Miss Carrie.
Not to be missed. And then just to remind everybody that this year, CARE is celebrating 20 years of being headquartered in Atlanta. We've been around for almost 70 years, but 20 of it here in Atlanta, and we're so proud of that. So we have an event on October 11th, that's next Friday, at Maison Muir Fine Art Gallery. An art exhibit showing the art of girls in our programs. You can go to www.care.org/art to read more about that. We'd love for you to join us. And then on October 18th, which is the next Friday, we have a dinner celebration at the Atlanta History Center. And that will be a tribute to our 20 years in Atlanta. And to learn more about that, you can go to www.care.org/celebrate.
So, and just sort of leaving our audience with sort of that last takeaway from what we have talked about today and what you all are doing great work in the community. If I were to ask you, Kelly, you know, in 10 words or less, what's the key message that you really want to make sure that our listeners take away from the work that you're doing in our community?
That it can be done. We can break the cycle of generational poverty for women and girls. We know what works. We've been doing it for years. We've been doing it on a small scale. We need to do it on a larger scale. And with the support of the community, we know that we can raise these women and girls out of that cycle of generational poverty, and it'll incredibly improve their lives, and it'll improve the community.
Okay, so it can be done, and we need to scale up.
That's right.
That's the message that you want to carry.
That's fantastic. I would say we want to increase concern about global poverty and its root causes and appreciation for CARE as a leader in the fight against it, and that we stand with women and girls in that journey.
Okay, so standing for women with girls in their journey. So I appreciate both of you taking the time to talk with us. Hope you've got good plans for the weekend. I think it's supposed to be nice and get a little cooler, actually, as we go through the weekend. So join us here next week at 10 o'clock for our Growth Matters show. And so let's talk about it, because
Growth Matters.